nation, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth. The Puppet Media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the new world order. Prepare yourself. This is the Alternative Media.
And we are back. Welcome to the Alternative Media. This is Hour 2. I'm Patrick Slattery, and we are fortunate enough, we still have Professor Kevin McDonald with us. And we also have a caller, Robert from North Carolina, who is somebody that you'll hear often calling in on Stormfront Radio. And he's actually the person who is responsible for initiating the debate between David Duke and Alex Jones. Frank from North Carolina. He initiated this debate that is known as the Jonestown Massacre. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Patrick. I was going to ask you, now, first of all, I did want to say, though, that Farron is one of my favorite talk show hosts. And I tell you, I'm so proud of him for getting in contact with you and putting the offer out there, and I'm so glad. I think this is a great opportunity, and I'm telling you, you are a natural. I mean, listening to you with Don Advo and listening to you with... Dr. Kevin McDonald, I mean, this is incredible. But
they make it easy for me. They make it easy for me because they're such great guests.
Hey, can you spell your last? Because I'm not on the. I'm one of these. I'm not on the. I'm kind of. I used to be on. I mean, obviously, I did many years of research on the internet and whatnot. But can you spell your last name for me, please?
S L A T T E R Y.
Okay, and how do you prefer to be addressed?
You can call me anything you want, except for late for breakfast. Dr. Duke calls me Dr. Slattery. He likes to use people's terms. If you want to call me Patrick, you can call me Patrick.
Okay, well, I like Patrick. But, it's just, this is such a... I mean, the rhythm that you have, you are a natural... I mean, the rhythm that you have with Don Advo... And with I mean, it's just incredible. And here with Dr. Kevin McDonald, I mean, you're getting so much powerful information out.
Very powerful information out. I appreciate that. You have a I know you've got a good question for Professor McDonald.
Well. No, I'm really enjoying listening to him on here. I can't believe this is happening, and I hope people will call in and donate, because RBN is it's like a tightrope, and I you know what, this is so great, and I mean, I love Farron and everything, but I mean, man, you guys, please call, donate, call in if you got any money, if you like this, if you enjoy it, if you're getting something out of it. I mean, this is and get information. I called into my local radio station the other day, Friday actually, right before Rush Limbaugh came on, and I made the statement live on air. I said the ADL is a front for organized crime, and the gay mafia is one of its tentacles, just one of many. Now, I don't know if you've been following what's going on here in North Carolina, but all hell's breaking loose here. They want the men dressed as women to be able to go into the bathrooms with women and children. And my mom is elderly. She does not like that. And I have other females, young and old, in my family group, and I don't appreciate that at all, because these people, the ones that I've come across, are very creepy people. I don't trust them. Anyway, I just
okay.
want to say keep up. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Really, and I'm going to transform that into a question for Professor McDonald. So, you know, in the 1980s, you had kind of a gay rights movement, or not even so much gay rights, but a movement that centered around AIDS research, and people could relate to AIDS research, you know, because AIDS was the gay plague at the time, and So they could identify with that. And then there was, well, discrimination at the workplace. And it kept advancing. Then it got to be gay marriage, which when it was first proposed in the 1990s, it sounded like a joke. It flies in the face of literally, really, I guess, billions of years of evolution. I guess algae or bacteria started sexually reproducing billions of years ago. But, through indoctrination through the media, it started to become kind of a hegemonic idea. Now we have gay marriage, and you would think that that's the terminal point. And yet the moment you get gay marriage, the next thing you've got, it goes beyond. It's the trans people. Nobody knew what trans meant. And now all of a sudden you've got this new political demand that anybody can decide their own gender, and it's the equivalent of racism, which is worse than cannibalism. To deny somebody the right to define their own gender. How does it come to this, Professor McDonald?
I don't know, the specific Jewish involvement in that, but it certainly is a project of the left. And certainly, as you say, the media was hugely involved. I mean, you had all these TV shows with, these sitcoms with gay people in there, sort of making people, sort of humanizing them. And, of course, a lot of them are nice. I mean, that's fine. But then you start to have gay marriage. And in the end, amazingly, the gay marriage thing was read into the Constitution as a right. People were not aware this was a right for a very, very long time. And now, as you say, this morphed into transgender. Now that they've got the gay marriage thing, they go into transgender. And I was amazed, but in North Carolina, I read something the other day that the LGBT crowd is not happy with having single-use bathrooms. That is, bathrooms only one person could go into. They want men to be able to go into women's bathrooms. And, again, if you're a woman or if I'm a father of a young girl, I'd just be horrified at the thought of that. I mean, and it's just amazing to think of it. But
and so you say...
The fact that they don't want the single-use bathroom just shows you this is in your face, just trying to undermine traditional sexual norms.
So even the I presume the L's in the LGBT community, the lesbians don't necessarily like to have cross-dressing men go into and share a bathroom with them.
I guess that's... I don't think anybody would. I noticed at the University of Toronto, they had this sort of transgender-friendly policy about bathrooms, and then they suspended it because there was all this voyeurism going on. You got guys in there with their phones, and they're trying to, they're filming things and peeking around and all this stuff. I mean, it's just crazy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So not only, you have to accept whatever gender or sexual orientation they have, who they want to have sex with, now we have to accept their own decision about whatever gender they are.
So you've got, maybe transgender people are 1% of the population, and they expect 99% of the people who feel uncomfortable with this to start being happy with it, and the other 1% to make them happy. It's just an inversion of reality. And the fact, again, the fact that they would reject single-use bathrooms shows they're not really interested in having a practical solution to this that would respect everybody's sort of natural proclivities. They want to change. They want to change society. They want to have men wandering around women's bathrooms. And if you don't like it, it's against the law. You'll be probably hauled up on charges at some point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm just going to remind the audience, if you want to pose a question for Professor McDonald, it is 1-800-313-9443. Now, Professor McDonald, there was a very interesting article that was published just within the past week by James Petras, who is a professor of sociology, I believe, at New York State University at Binghamton, which is a fairly prestigious public school, a state school. And James Petras is definitely somebody from the left. He's been an advisor to left-wing governments in Latin America. He was an advisor to the Papandreou's government when it was in charge of Greece. Yet he's always been outspoken. He's a Latin American specialist, but he's always been outspoken about what he calls the Zionist power configuration. And, you know, the way he looks at Jewish power in the United States is really pretty similar to the way we do, the way David Duke does. You know, when David Duke talks about Jewish supremacism, it's really not that different from the Zionist power configuration. And in this article he wrote, he started off by talking about the appointment of Merrick Garland to be what would be the fourth Jewish Supreme Court justice, 4 out of 9. And then he goes on to talk about, just as is the case with Elena Kagan, who had very scant qualifications, not just for the Supreme Court, but basically for every job she got. And perhaps he had read my paper, because I had pointed out every job she got throughout her career, even internships, were Jewish. You know, she had Jewish benefactors. She had Congresswoman Holtzman, who gave her an internship, Gerald Stone, who was the head of the law school at University of Chicago, gave her her first job. She really didn't have very good, and gave her tenure, despite having not really published anything. And then Lawrence Summers, who Petras names as the president of the Harvard, appointing her the head of the Harvard Law School, despite having not had any publishing record, or just being very mediocre. And she's a case study. But then he goes on and he lists heads of the bureaucracy our economic bureaucracy, whether it's the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, the Commerce Department, and he talks about the foreign policy establishment, like some of these new neocons that we were talking about, the same ones, as a matter of fact, Pearl and Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz. And these are people who all got degrees from elite universities, Harvard in particular, Harvard and Yale. And yet when you look at their, and of course, you know, we've talked a great deal about preferential treatment they get. They get into these schools, and while Jewish students might perform slightly better on their SATs, it doesn't go near explaining their 25 or 30% populations in these schools. Their admission rates are almost entirely due to nepotism, as Ron Unz has pointed out. He doesn't talk so much about that, but he talks about when they get out, they get put in these elite positions, and if you look at their work, and this is something you were touching on in the last hour, their work is horrible. The results that they've gotten, destroying the economy, wars everywhere. I mean, the world is kind of facing a collapse, and everywhere that's doing badly, you've got this Jewish domination. The few places around the world that have really done well over the past several decades are places where you have less Jewish influence, places in East Asia where the Jews just can't masquerade themselves, where Jews are obviously not part of the in-group and aren't allowed to dominate society. Professor McDonald, you've read or you're familiar with James Petras's article.
Absolutely, it's a very good article in a lot of ways. It's interesting to see this sort of thing coming from the left. In a way, it shouldn't be that surprising that it comes from the left, but, you know, as you were sort of suggesting, it'd be nice if he'd cited us, because, I've written about Kagan, you've written about Kagan, I've written about these neocons a lot, I've written about, the role of Summers and so on. So, yeah, I mean, we're all aware of this, but it's nice to see it sort of coming from a different direction. He's a smart guy, and Actually, some of the stuff was new. You know, I was amazed at some of the details. And you know, the fact that these people are, you know, again, they coming from these elite schools. This is the original sin, as it were. I mean, the fact that they are way overrepresented at Harvard, Yale, and so on. And then they get, you know, ushered into really top-level jobs. And they use those jobs to advance Jewish interests. I mean, that's the simple reality. And you know, from the left, I was really struck by his economic analysis, you know, that all these free trade agreements and so on. This is a Jewish, led phenomenon, and it's really been disastrous for American workers, for disastrous for the American middle class, but it's enriched Wall Street. And that's where these guys are. I mean, Larry Summers is not only corrupt in terms of nepotism, you know, helping along Kagan's career, and I'm sure a lot of others, not only defending Israel to the max at Harvard, and you know, but also, you know, he's been corrupt. I mean, he's personally enriched himself. He was involved in the rape of the Soviet Union and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, so where all these Jewish oligarchs essentially got huge money. Harvard eventually had to pay a trivial fine for that. But, you know, they were all basically Jews. And this guy Schlieffer and Summers, they were all up to their neck in this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's such a huge scandal. And people should be aware of it.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that rape of Russia. What happened after the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, you know, President Yeltsin took over in what was really pretty much a coup d'etat, the way the Soviet Union was dismembered, and he maintained control over Russia. A lot of people forget about this by unleashing the tanks on the Parliament, which had just impeached him. They impeached him. He should have, and the Constitutional Court, their Supreme Court, upheld the impeachment. He takes out the tanks and blasts the Parliament building and arrests the Parliament leaders and the Vice President, who should have been the President. But the Jewish nature of the takeover of Russia in the 90s is amazing, and from the outside, from America officialdom, you had Lawrence Summers, who at the time was an assistant secretary of Treasury. He was sent over to Russia as an advisor to the Russian government. He brought over this Harvard gang. So you had you mentioned Schlieffer, who I believe is an emigre to the United States, a Jewish emigre. Peter Orszag, a young man who later became Obama's director of the budget director, and in the meantime, he was also the chief advisor to the Icelandic government when Iceland melted down. I mean, these people have such a track record of disaster, and then he brought over Jeffrey Sachs, the Jewish economist, who's always promoting himself as the next head of the World Bank or the next Secretary of Treasury. He's amazing at self-promotion. I hear the music coming up, but I want to stay on this a little bit more. And if you want to call in, that number was 1-800-313-9443. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. That's some Russian-sounding music. Let's continue on that theme, Professor McDonald. There was basically a Jewish takeover of Russia under President Yeltsin. And yet President Yeltsin, you know, he brought over these Jewish advisors from the United States. And then he brought in a lot of young Jews into his government. And the big thing was the privatization of state assets, because under the Soviet Union, all factories, all land was owned by the state. And these Jewish advisors from the Treasury Department were saying, you have to, you know, Jeffrey Sachs and them, you have to privatize, and it has to be, you know, radical privatization. It has to be shock therapy. You have to do it all at once. And then his minister for privatization was a Jewish man named Anatoly Chubais, who became a very rich man in the process of this. And basically what happened is you had these Jews who were brought into the Russian government and these American Jewish advisors who wind up connecting Jewish international capital, like George Soros, who is very involved in this, to young Jews in Russia. They had access to capital at a time when the ruble had completely collapsed, and so nobody had any money. You had starvation, you had people freezing, and nobody had any money to purchase these state assets. People were given these vouchers, these pieces of paper, but you know, one piece of paper by itself wasn't going to get you very far. And people would sell them at bargain basement prices to these people who wound up becoming the oligarchs. They accumulated all of these vouchers and were able to take over oil industry, gas industry, telecommunications, banks. They took over everything. And in the process, you had what was called a demographic collapse of Russia. You had a population contraction. People were dying more than they were being born. The average life expectancy of a Russian man fell from something like 66 down to 58. A UN study released recently showed, I can't remember whether it was, you know, a couple of million. It was well over a million people died prematurely because of this. It was really kind of a genocide. And Russia got taken over by these oligarchs. Yeltsin has partly displaced them, and that's part of why they hate him so much. And he's in their target, in their trigger hairs, if that's what you call it. But Professor McDonald, so that episode in Russia, how does your theory of hyper ethnocentrism and this ethnocentrism as kind of an evolutionary strategy, how does that play into your theory? How would you explain this by your theory?
Well, you know, it's a classic example of Jewish ethnic networking. All of these people, the Harvard team, are all Jews. You look at the oligarchs. I think one may not have been Jewish. A very Jewish undertaking. Just another example of ethnic networking at the top of society, having very influential positions and roles. It's an amazing story, and I think this is what motivated Vladimir Putin. You know, they, these guys were not just into all the economics; they had part of that with the telecommunications, and so they were controlling the media. And during one of the last election campaigns before Putin, you saw this coalition or alliance among people like Michael Kordakovsky, who was the guy who ended up with the oil industry, and
Jewish oligarch,
the result was to take over the political process. I mean, sort of in a much the same way we have here, where you have Jewish domination of the media, and they promote certain political issues and candidates and so on. Well, that's what they had in the Soviet Union, in Russia after the fall there. And Putin, to his credit, I think saw that and realized this cannot happen. And he stripped the oligarchs. He got the oligarchs, I think, out of politics. They still exist to some extent. He put Khodorkovsky in prison for a long time, and it was a signal that these people couldn't do that anymore. And I think Russia is freer of Jewish media domination, sort of, than the West is at this point. But still, the economic effects of this, of the rape of Russia, are still resonating, and it's just this humanitarian disaster, really, for the Russian people. And it's so ironic, you had the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, and Jews dominating Russia, murdering millions of people. And then at the very end of Russia, of the Soviet Union, you have these Jews coming in and raping Russia once again, and impoverishing it, and taking over the media and everything. All the recent national resources. So it's like, some things never change.
Yeah, and neither of these episodes you can really talk about. At least you can't talk about them, the Jewish role in them. And, no. You had the people responsible from the American side, Summers or Orzag or Jeffrey Sachs, they, you know, they're massive, what you'd have to say a failure from the point of view of the Russian people, are they, but yet they continue to be feted. They get promoted. Summers after that became the Secretary of Treasury.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's really true. I mean, it's like Summers was rewarded for all this. I mean,
he was rewarded.
It's just astonishing. Then he becomes president of Harvard. Oh, it's just amazing. It's just amazing.
Okay, we're up on the break. We will be back with Professor McDonald after the break. Back. This is the Alternative Media. I'm Patrick Slattery. I'm with Professor McDonald. And, you know, we had been talking about the massive theft of, the Russian people's assets during the 1990s and what a disaster it was for them. And one of the things that Professor Petras had pointed out is, you know, if you look at the results of Lawrence Summers or these other people's policies from a national interest point of view, they're disasters. But if you looked at it from the point of view of Israel, but you could say really from what's good for the Jews. And if you look at Russia, if you look at, for instance, our own financial meltdown 8 years ago, they resulted in transfer of assets from non-Jews to Jews, frankly. So whether or not they were disasters, I suppose it depends on your point of view. We have some callers, and I love having Professor McDonald here answering my questions, but there are other people with questions. We have Eddie from Ohio. Are you there, Eddie?
Yeah, I'm here.
And do you have a question for Professor McDonald?
Actually, I just had a comment. These Jews are not as smart as everybody makes them out to be. What happens is very simply, let's say they're in a college, right, and your father happens to be a college professor in some other college, then he can get all the answers because he has access to the answers to whatever college course you're taking. So, of course, these people are going to have better grades than you are while you're sweating somewhere trying to obtain the answers by studying. They already have the answer book. Of course, they're going to get these great degrees, and they are going to move on in life, and you're going to be stuck somewhere working for them. But they're not really smarter than anybody else, nor are they as powerful as everybody makes them to be. They just cheat better than anybody else. That's all I had to say. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, thanks for the call, Eddie. So this issue of Jewish intelligence and possibly having higher IQs. So how much of this is due to high IQs? How much of it is due to ethnic networking?
Well, again, as you mentioned earlier, we're talking about admission to Harvard and so on. Jews are overrepresented when you correct for IQ. White European descended people are way underrepresented. Jews are overrepresented by a factor of 15 after correcting for IQ and academic achievement. So it's really about ethnic networking. It's about these admissions offices preferring Jewish applicants. And that's really the story. And it's the same thing, really. With these other, you know, someone like Wolfowitz would say, I mean, I don't think it's not like he's stupid or anything. He's got a PhD. I'm sure he's a smart guy. But, he's not any smarter than a whole host of non-Jews. And he's gotten where he is today. And all these people that Petras mentions, and, you mentioned, and I mentioned in my work, they get there at least partly because of who they know. I mean, Kagan is just a classic example of someone. And when she got appointed to the Supreme Court, there were all these articles in the Wall Street Journal and other places talking about meritocracy, that finally, back in the bad old days, those evil WASPs used to favor their own, and promote their own. And now we have a meritocracy. And you can see that because someone like Kagan is on the Supreme Court. And it's like they just say this with a straight face as if it could, it's amazing. I mean, she had no publications worth mentioning, two or three small ones. I don't think I could have gotten tenure at Cal State Long Beach with her publication record. I mean, it was just abysmal. And then she suddenly appears at Gina Harvard Law School, Solicitor General, Supreme Court. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to see it. And you see, there were all these newspaper articles, before she was even suggested as a Supreme Court. Even when Sotomayor was nominated, and then they were pushing her at that time. But then when Sotomayor got that, they were ready the next time, and the same people in the media, all Jewish, were promoting her, saying, "Oh, she's on the short list. She's really good." Lawrence Tribe, for one, a Harvard professor of law, saying how wonderful she was and all that. And sure enough, she got it.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the Ivy League admissions, so you see, 25%, usually at least 25% Jewish. Now you also see around 16% Asian. And what's really remarkable is that if you look what happens after college, and you see all these young Jews who are, for instance, in the media. I saw a CNN program the other day with a 29-year-old Jewish host, and they get into the New York Times, they get into the media, they get into other powerful positions in the bureaucracy and elsewhere. You don't see hardly any Asians. So if it was just the pedigree, just the Ivy League pedigree, you would expect to see, maybe almost as many Asians as you see Jews. You don't see it. So it's not just the pedigree. There's something else at play here.
Or people of European descent as well, you'd see.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've done articles and all kinds of different things related to that. I mean, I wrote one on this novelist, a Jewish novelist, and he, people were sort of marveling, how did his book get reviewed everywhere? It's reviewed in the New York Times, New York Review of Books, everywhere. And suddenly he's a star, I mean, that's how it works.
That's great.
Where if you had just this non-Jewish guy, he couldn't even get his book published, much less reviewed everywhere and praised to the sky by these Jewish reviewers. I mean, it's just amazing to see see how it works.
Right, and then you think of for instance, the internet, the .com companies, or these new startup companies, and it's not as if white Europeans don't have ideas, but you have to have access to capital, and they have access to capital, they have access to these opportunities. Donald Trump's been lambasted because he had a $1 million loan from his father. It's no big deal for a young 20-something-year-old Jewish person to get $1 million loan from venture capitalists. It happens all the
many,
time.
Many, many millions of dollars. Yeah, I mean, no question.
Right. Okay, we have Dan in Washington. Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for taking the call.
Okay, and what's your question for Professor McDonald?
Well, I got two questions. It kind of changed when I was listening to you guys. The world is flat. I think his name is Friedman.
Yes, Friedman. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times.
Yeah, and they always quote this guy like he's some genius. But even as a college kid, I realized that his opinions made no sense as far as free trade. His whole theory is that the world's flat and we don't need tariffs. He lies and he doesn't cover the history of tariffs. And he basically just says that's just old stupid stuff, and free trade is great, and now that we have cars and trains, that everything's going to work out fine, And it's like he just sits there and kind of ignores certain facts,
He was somebody, my mother had the same gripe against him. Everybody treats him like he's just a fountain of knowledge. So, Professor, what about people like Thomas Friedman, who, they'll write a book, the Earth is flat, and then a few years later they're writing a book that's saying something completely different. They've made all these mistakes, yet nobody remembers their mistakes. I mean, how does that happen and they don't lose their credibility?
Well, it's a good example. Someone who's promoting free trade, I think that was a theme of Petras's article, that these trade deals really have benefited Wall Street and the sort of oligarchic elites have not helped American workers at all. It's been a disaster, and that's part of the big groundswell for Trump. Certainly Trump's big issue has been immigration, but his second issue, maybe even as important, has been economic nationalism and opposing these trade deals. And that has resonated with an awful lot of people. Pat Buchanan has been flogging this for years and with no success. I mean, he always points out America became a great industrial country when we had a sense of economic nationalism, when we imposed tariffs in certain areas and so on. And that's how we became great. And that's the way China is doing it, Japan. But we're sort of allowing them to do this. And it's an incredible thing. And I actually just wrote an article. I'm going to send it off tomorrow. There's an article by a guy named James Trusinski in The Federalist, and he's going on about how the alt-right, you know, these conservative, these new quote racists that support Trump, they are they're economic nationalists, and that's horrible because they seem moral for anybody to be because economic individualism and free trade are part of some kind of divine human order that if you go against it, it's immoral, and that's sort of the way it is now. I mean, free trade is ensconced as the moral absolute, and Friedman buys into that completely.
Right. Hey, thanks for your call, Dan.
Okay.
And we have Jeff in Idaho. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. McDonald. Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi, yeah.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, this is a continuation of the from before. This is like a Farron kind of comment. The book, have you ever heard of the book Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve by John Graham? Dr. McDonald?
I haven't. Have you, Professor McDonald?
I haven't really heard that one, no.
Okay, well, what it does is it shows essentially the setup between the North and the South, how it was put together over like 20 or 30 years to bring in the Civil War and then basically bring in the Chase ruling for, the greenback. And then I was just wanting to, basically the model that I wanted to apply was, the takeover during the Civil War, which the Civil War never really ended because the de jure government never really returned. But this is what they did to Russia twice, in the October Revolution, not the March Revolution, but the October Revolution of 1917. And then yeah. Stalin basically stopped them, sort of, when he died, and Khrushchev took over, and he was a nationalist, kind of like Putin and like what you call Trump. And then what happens is when the Reaganites, with their kind of cabal of the peanut guys, brought down Russia the second time, and they sent in this other wave, the Summers guys that you're talking about. This is essentially a tactic for destabilization. And the free traders are basically the original British East India Company. The United States erected the trade barriers to stop the British East India Company after the Declaration of Independence. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So what they've done is, with the Civil War, they've just like rammed that stuff down. And so this Jewish supremacism is about the British East India Trading Company free trade model. Right? Mm-hmm. They're like a 300-year section of time.
Professor McDonald, have you looked into, say, Jewish power in the British Empire or in America around the antebellum or postbellum period around the Civil War?
Well, I haven't really done much on that. On Occidental Observer, Occidental Quarterly, Andrew Joyce has written a couple articles about Jewish power in the British Empire, with the Boer War, for example. It was basically about Jewish economic domination of South Africa and that sort of thing. There's no question.
And very powerful. Yeah. And you had the Opium War, which I believe was at the behest of the Sassoon family that dominated the opium
Correct.
Trade in China.
Right.
Right. Okay. Thanks for your call.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, did you have another comment? Okay, and I want to make sure we get to our callers. We have Jimmy in Florida. Jimmy, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. What's on your mind, Jimmy?
I want to know why the clergy of this country, the Christian Zionists, or the, I call them Christian quacks, why they think the people of Israel are God's chosen people. There are no more God's chosen people than a man in the moon. And they always talk about the Holy Hoax. They don't ever talk about the Christians that was killed during the Russian Revolution.
Very
and
true.
I'll okay. listen to you answer, okay?
Okay. So Christian, there's two elements there. One is Christian Zionism. How did Christian Zionism come to dominate so much of Christianity in America? And then the contrast in the handling between the handling of the Holocaust, which has really become kind of morphed into a religion, a state religion, even in and more so in Europe than in America, even the contrast between that and the Jewish atrocities that were committed other times, including the decade or two immediately prior to World War II, was, you know, the various Bolshevik revolutions, not just in Russia, but in other places in Europe that were more short-lived, and the Holodomor. So what about those two issues?
Well, certainly there's no question that Christian Zionism is an important it's important in this country, and it is. Quite a few of these organizations are actually run by Jews, and there's a very interesting history with Samuel Untermeyer. We've got a few things on Occidental Observer about how Samuel Untermeyer, who was a very wealthy Jewish guy at the turn of the century, of the 19th century, early 20th century. Actually promoted this Bible that stressed this sort of Zionist program, and all the footnotes, the so-called Schofield Bible, very pro-Zionist, and they got it published by Oxford University Press, and it became a sort of standard among American Protestants and British Protestants, that very much emphasizes the idea of Israel as a Jewish hope and so on, much more so. And especially if you look at the footnotes and all the things that were added, it's very pro-Zionist, and that's the whole point of this. And so it's another example how Jews have influenced Christian culture. My view is that these people are they're dupes. They're being used, they sincerely believe this kind of thing. But it's very sad to see it, because they've really collaborated in some of the just incredible atrocities and so on in Israel, the ethnic apartheid, the ethnic cleansing, all the while Jewish organizations in this country are preaching for more immigration and tolerance and ethnic harmony and all that. Israel is doing just the opposite. So it's an amazing story that is not well known.
And Christian Zionist movement itself, the biggest organization is Christians United for Israel, which is nominally led by that pastor from San Antonio, whose name slips my mind, but the actual executive chairman of the
organization.
John Hagee. But the actual executive director is a man named Brogue. I forgot his first name, but he is the first cousin of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Yeah. So you have not just a Jew, but the first cousin of a Jewish prime minister who is leading a Christian Zionist organization. Okay, we are have a break, and then we're up for our last segment in the second hour with Professor Kevin MacDonald. Media. I'm your host, Patrick Slattery, and we're here with Professor MacDonald for our last segment. And, Professor, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show. You know, this has been fascinating. I've learned so much personally, and I'm sure that as soon as the show's over, I'm going to be thinking, oh, I wanted to ask about this. So I'm hoping perhaps you'll be willing to come on again at some point, because you've been great. And I want to give you the opportunity to talk about, bring up any issue that you want to, plug anything that you need to plug. You have your website, which I want you to tell people about. And then if there's any time left, what about the Trump phenomenon?
Well, that's a big topic, and it's something that I
know. And we only have about 3 minutes, but...
Yeah, you know, something I'm very excited about. At the same time, I'm a little depressed right now that it looks to me like they are going to steal it from him, despite his having more votes than anybody else. We'll see, though. I mean, he could win New York and California really big, and if so, he might have enough delegates. But a lot of people, even his supporters, like Roger Stone, has written a lot. Do believe that there's going to be some kind of a stealing at the convention, but he has changed the game, and it's no accident, I think, that the alt-right, the alternative right, is getting a lot more attention because really we're the only people that speak for Trump voters. Trump voters are completely left out from the Rainbow Coalition of the left. You know, the party of the racially aggrieved Democrats, but they're also left out of the Beltway right. You know, they are not, they're not represented by the neoconservatives, who are basically leftists who have infiltrated the Republican Party. They're not represented by the free trade, Chamber of Commerce people who want cheap labor and open borders. These are people who are really populist. They want to end immigration as we know it. They want to build a wall. They want to prevent Muslims from coming here. They want their country back. And Trump is the only one that's speaking for them. Now, Ted Cruz has mouthed some of the same positions. Who can believe that he really believes it? You know, he's someone who's changed his position completely on immigration, only saying it now to be more like Trump. It's really a scandal. So, but this may change America. I'm hopeful that even if Trump doesn't win this time, that he starts some kind of political movement. And I do think that if he is not nominated, that whoever is nominated will lose, and that's the good news. I think the Republican Party has to be destroyed because it is so corrupt. Again, you've got these oligarchic billionaires who run out, including the Republican Jewish Coalition, which is meeting right now in Las Vegas. And you know what? And I just got a tweet from David Frum, who was there. Ted Cruz said at that convention that we are a nation of immigrants. I'll tell you something, that is not something that Donald Trump would ever say. And we have to hope that he's going to win this thing.
And I'm actually still pretty optimistic. Won't go into that now, but he's doing really well in the polls in New York, and that's the next state. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Could you say the name of your website, how people can find your writings?
Yeah, the main thing now is the Occidental Quarterly. But to find out all that information, go to the Occidental Observer, theoccidentalobserver.net. I write a lot on there. Right now we have very interesting articles, which is basically a book review of a book on the Holocaust. Really interesting stuff by Andrew Joyce. He's a PhD in history, and Jewish history in particular. This guy knows an awful lot of very interesting material, I'm very enthusiastic about his writing, so I want to promote him and promote our website. We're doing very well, getting a lot of very good writers. TheOccidentalObserver.net. Check it out.
Check it out. Thank you. And thank you you've published a couple of my articles up there, too, so I want to thank you for that. That's actually what got
me, as I recall.
Yeah, and that's what got me connected with David Duke. So thank you for that. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be back after the top of the hour with a great new guest. Thank you so much, Professor McDonald.
Thank you.